my sons have hate it. Instead of them one like them, my sons have job. Israel is like them no member. Them a go reap where them sow on ya. And in a go pretty. Yeah, the judgment of Jah is not a pity. And those who live in shitty with the children of humanity. Hey, Noah who make the people a stop. The government who if he blame for the war. The government who make life get so hard around the world. Yes, who if he blame for it all. The government who make the stock market crash. The government then make the economy flop. The government build the pressure down and our banks against the wall. Yeah, who if he blame for it all. The Noah who make the people a stop. The government who if he blame for the war. The government who make life get so hard around the world. Yes, who if he blame for it all. The government who make the stock market crash. The government.
Confidence in I am Jaja, who are you now going to make with suffer, and then they try them up with scatter and batter and flatter.
Protect my people, Jah. No let them get caught in the crossfire. Protect my nation, Jaja, cause we no want in a land to no flatter. Protect my people, Jah. A Babylon start this wildfire. Protect my nation, Jaja, Jaja. Protect my nation, Jaja. Downtown and on the ground, and all the potential troubles around. Mark up prophecy, head I go roll. Me wonder if prophecy I go unfold. Uptown can go downtown, you know. All country people worried, you know. We means of survival worried. Worried in our middle sex and well I'm sorry. Father help me. Some man out of mercy. Father help me. Preserve Jamaica beauty. We want you protect my people, Jah. Now make them get caught in the crossfire. Protect my nation, Jaja. Hey, protect my people, Jaja. Hey, look at the youth, them. Watch them. Can the beast have a system? Trap them. The police and the dogs are your children. Are you alone? I was already to judge them. Could I go suffer for father? The place I don't mind. Don't make it get bad like over Baghdad. When politics fail and religion fail, the most I alone will. Protect your people, Jah. Now make them get caught in the crossfire. Protect my people, Jah. Cause we no harm in a land to no flatter. Protect your people, Jah. A Babylon start this wildfire. Protect your people, Jah, 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 Jah. Protect your people, Jah. I tell a town and a playground, you know. Holy potential troubles around. Mark up prophecy, it a go roll. Me wonder if I know prophecy, ya and fall. Uptown can go downtown, you know. All country people worried, you know. We means of survival worried. Worries in a middle sex and well I'm sorry. Father help me. Some man out of mercy. If we stay help me. Preserve and make a beauty. Ooh. Why you protect your people, Jah? Now let them get caught in the crossfire. Protect your nation, Jaja. A Babylon start this wildfire. Protect your people, Jah. Cause they don't know what them doing. Protect your people, Jaja. Mind your own place, get your thing.
Confident in I am. Jaja, when you're not gonna make me suffer, and then miss find them a bit scatter and butter and flatter.
Producer, where you say that rhythm there? All right. You mean on Jamaica, New York, London.
Play back that tape there for me.
Yeah. Boom. You are play a bad man and bust the askelly. Better that the whole of steady meddy. Cause you not know how to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. You rap the old lady and laugh like it's funny. You ramp with poor people money. And you not know how to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. Who asked me that? That's a me old time granny. She said, son, you're not for roll out with no strap in the valley. Watch out for the wicked when you're dilly or your dally. That's why me tell the ghetto youths go school and go study. Cause the road get muddy, cause the sidewalk bloody. Burn the idol as a man a body. Now make them sell you up and carry you in the alley. You are play a bad man and bust the askelly. Better that the whole of steady medi. Cause you not know how I talk how a pumpkin belly. How I talk how a pumpkin belly. You rap the old lady and laugh like it's funny. You ramp with poor people money. And you not know how I talk how a pumpkin belly. How I talk how a pumpkin belly. Watch a little barefoot you turn in at the bus. When you used to sell the buckles and white the car glass. Go to college, take the test and impass. Stacking up the money, moving up fast. But no still a grudge, cause they don't know them live in a glass house. And still a chose zone. Get to use me proud because you did it on your own. But no for them a go on like Sylvester Stallone. You are play a bad man and bust the askelly. Better that the whole of steady medi. Cause you not know how to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. You rap the old lady and laugh like it's funny. You ramp with poor people money. And you not know how to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. Who asked me that? That's a me old time granny. She said, son, you're not for roll out with no strap in the valley. Watch out for the wicked when you're dilly or your dally. That's why me tell the ghetto youths go school and go study. Cause the road get muddy and the sidewalk bloody. Burn the idol as the man a body. Now make them sell you up and carry you in the alley. You are play a bad man and bust the askelly. Better that the whole a steady medi. Cause you not know how to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly. You rap the old lady and laugh like it's funny. You ramp with poor people money. And you not know how to walk our pumpkin belly. How to walk our pumpkin belly.
Rising Star Chronics.
Please don't chop it down. Plant it.
A tune called Plant It. Before that, we heard Geppy Ranks, Pumpkin Belly. Taris Riley with Wildfire. Pita Morgan, The Government. And J Bug, Coldest Zone. Free Radio Santa Cruz. High Grade Reggae. Bless up.
I flow, we are flow down Babylon. A avocado, a we are top of fear. We plant in a France, now they want top of fear. Oh, boy, yo. Who's fear? The youth, them not no money start. Only when them cut it down, them a who's fear? Them say them not take no top, but chronics, I tell them we plant it. Plant it. Babylon beg you not cut it, beg you please don't cut it down. Plant it, because the people them want it. Want it, I beg you. Plant it. Babylon beg you not cut it, I beg you not cut it down. Plant it, plant it, plant it. One, two, make it flow the earth. Babylon, I beg you load the earth. Charities you assert me, but you no want get dirty. So you stay wide and loaded, yeah. But when I farming Spartan, eh, you must think the ground only good for what part. Now me have done the color to be easy, the dumpling. Not to mention when me reap up the pumpkin, me I beg you no plant. I'm Babylon, I beg you don't, I beg you do not chop it, no. Plant it, no, no. Because the people, them want people them want it.
That's some great music, but coming up next, we got a lot of chatter. It's Bathrop Spears Broadsides coming to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours, so stay tuned.
It's a question, who owns the land? Who owns the land? Who owns the land?
And you'll have to answer that one yourself. Maybe the land owns its own self, as land, the song Land goes by five. So, stay tuned now, as mentioned before, for 2 hours of fun and frolics, mostly older interviews that I'm going to be catching up on here for the next 2 hours. Street stuff from Santa Cruz, maybe an occasional call-in. I'm hoping for a couple of updates. We had a Huff meeting yesterday and a meeting of the U.S. out of Ukraine group, and we're going to perhaps hear from Dennis Edler, who's going to be talking about that. And a few other num-nums along the way. Plus, of course, your phone calls. 831-427-3772 is the call-in number here. Again, 831-427-3772 if you'd like to get in touch. I may be able to do a report on the upcoming city council meeting on Tuesday, the agenda, at least, of what they are planning to shovel down our throats. If the agenda goes back online, about half an hour ago it was offline, but I contacted the city clerk administrator by email, and she is up apparently past the usual business hours, good for her, and has emailed me back that she's trying to put it back online. So you'll be able to read all the things you don't want to read and see what the council is going to be doing in your name. Anyway, let's begin with some street interviews from late March. Not to mention some street commentary from yours truly. Again, if you have any announcements or updates, please do call in, 427-3772. If you have donations, if you have questions about our schedule, go to our website, freakradio.org. One letter, or one word, small letters, freakradio, one word. And you can check that stuff out, plus see some archives, or I should say hear some archives, from different shows. Mine, the archives to this show, however, another website, the Huff website, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, at huffsantacruz.org. Indeed. And let's hear some stuff from the streets.
So it's about 10 after 9. And I just talked to Pan, the Pan man. He plays the big walks. And we have a illegal accordion player, an attractive illegal accordion player, and her associate, the kazoo player, and his an illegal third, the guitar player, and an illegal display device. Ah! Let's listen in. Babe in a baby carriage with a sign, family struggling. Also illegal at night. I've seen, what, four illegal things? We have the three musicians illegal. We have a man I just spoke to about to light a cigarette illegal. We have the pan player. No. Evening, we have, the pan drum pan player. What the heck was he playing? Those walks, whatever they're called. And he was illegal because he was both smoking and I guess that was the main reason he was illegal.
And in fact, the reason that most performers are playing illegally on Pacific Avenue is because the new sidewalk shrinkage laws provide for only a 5% of the avenue to be legal spots, and then only for an hour at a time once a day. And that, of course, is makes it extremely difficult for people to actually stay within the law. Plus, you're supposed to be take up an area of no more than 12 square feet, which essentially is three big squares on Pacific Avenue, if you know what the sidewalk looks like.
Find crime everywhere on Pacific Avenue. An illegal dog walker. Looks like a woman with a very revealing nylon stockings, long hair, and a dog. Rather large dog on a leash, but after dark. We have a man from Frisco with a sign, "Thank the Lord Jesus," on his backpack. What are you thanking the Lord for at this time?
Right now, I'm just putting him first so that if he wants to give me another guitar, I'm open to it.
Your guitar disappeared on the wharf in San Francisco?
Yeah, I went to sleep in the last rains of February, and the rumor is that people came from downtown and, you know, robbed everybody, basically. So,
wow. And so how did you make your way back here? Panhandling, I assume?
No, I had $13 left over. I took the city buses that connect from San Francisco, San Mateo, San Jose to here. So I just rode the buses.
And how is it now that you're back?
Other than the cigarette laws, it's about the same as it was 8 years ago.
And how does it feel?
Good to be home. I'm glad to be out of Oklahoma.
And San Francisco?
No, I'll miss San Francisco, but I gotta start, so I gotta start fresh, and that's why I come home.
And we've been talking with
Chris Kinney from Santa Cruz, California.
Thank you, Chris. So you just asked me about Cosmic Chris, and you just learned of his death some years ago.
Yeah, I came down here in 2005 promoting my new CD at the time, and he came up, said we jammed together, and then I didn't see him again. I'm stunned. I'm really stunned. He was a good musician and a great mentor. He helped me out a lot in 98 and 99. Yeah.
Well, one of his colleagues, Vision Song Valerie, told me that he essentially was driven to his death by the police because they harassed him until his vehicle was taken from him, ticketed him until he couldn't pay the fines, and then he died outside of illnesses.
Wow, he had a lot stronger character than that. I think there was a little bit more to it than that.
Probably.
It seems like, I mean, for him to be that backup, that's pretty. Yeah, he was a strong-willed character, man. I really loved him as a friend. He was honest to the point, and he was a hell of an Eagles player.
Yeah, we've been talking to
Chris Kinney from Santa Cruz.
The other Chris.
The Cosmic Man. I'll miss you, boy. Thank you.
You are the new Cosmic Chris.
No, I've just always been just Chris.
Thanks, Chris. So it is April 5th, 2014, about 20 to 8, and I'm in the beautiful Felton outside talking with a man who we'll call Chuck, just for the hell of it. That's not his real name, but that's fine, because what he has to say is more important than his name. How's it going tonight, Chuck?
I'm well. How are you?
Okay, you know, taking it slow, not too cold yet. I know that we kind of first ran into each other the evening I was arrested for having an unattended tape recorder at City Council, and we were talking about the issue of the whole Occupy movement. Actually, I was talking with Grant Wilson, who's a member of the Santa Cruz 11. Both of us have charges dismissed, but there's still four individuals who still face bogus charges around the issue of simply being in a political protest inside a building. And you had some pretty strong thoughts about the whole situation, which I thought were interesting, and I think you thought were, well, something you wanted to say in a more public manner. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is.
So, let's begin. Where do you want to begin?
Well, first of all, I'd like to talk about my background.
Okay.
I'm currently a security guard. I've I'm currently receiving training from Cal Sega. So I'm doing correspondent courses with them in law and also police tactics, and tactics for crowd control. I have a hobby of doing research into military and intelligence materials to understand how the government trains people to think in order to perform their jobs effectively. I have a firm belief that a Occupy movement and a movement that learns how to think in an effective, critical, and tactical manner has the ability to evade and be a more efficient movement, thereby actually being able to force the government into consolidations and
concessions
mm-hmm. in order to create a structure that we actually feel is in our best interest. In fact, today I was actually watching a documentary on the art of war and listening to a lecture that was from late Yale regarding politics and The Prince, the book that talks about tactics for controlling a populace.
Machiavelli,
yeah. And, you know, I definitely felt a huge distress in how I felt our movement was unorganized and inefficient and, you know, how we were effectively just being pushed around and just falling apart, and that made me, you know, really, really strive to do more research into what it would take to create a more learned and educated movement that was able to tackle the issues that we faced.
Mm. Now, how long were you involved with the Occupy movement, and when did you when did you notice it in Santa Cruz happening? I know I showed up at the first big meeting in Loudon Nelson Park. This is the only time we ever met there, but it was a big meeting. There were like a couple hundred people there.
Yeah, I was at that meeting.
And that was, you know, everybody was, it was kind of a wild and crazy. Everyone was speaking. I recorded a lot of it. What was your impression of that meeting? And then kind of take off from there as to what you saw in the movement that interested you.
My impression of that meeting was that I think that there were a lot of intelligent individuals, but, you know, Santa Cruz is in a very emotional and individualistic place, and that, you know, we were already having issues with finding ways to connect and finding common goals. Once the movement actually started, I think that we started in a good fashion. We started in a relatively organized fashion. One of the first night that we were on the court steps, in which I was there, there was a man who was with us who was former Special Forces. He was a former Navy SEAL, and he was probably the toughest one of us, and he was the only one that would not let the sheriffs move him that night. Everyone else, including me, left, although we did come back. And that one guy stayed there. He stayed there, and he said, "I don't care." He said, "I served. I've been shot at. These cops are nothing. I am going to do what the fuck I want to do, and if they want to take me to jail, well, they can take me to fucking jail."
You know, I remember the first night, I don't think I stayed the night, but I remember when they tried to drive everybody away, my response was, wait a minute, you can't, you know, this is a public space, nobody's, first they said, you all have to leave and take everything with you, and I said, no, because, you know, you might be able to cite people for camping or sleeping, although it wasn't even after 11, I don't think, when they first came. They had driven us away, as I remember, from the park at the top of the Mission Street Hill, where we were earlier in the day, and then we came to the courthouse steps, if I remember correctly. And people were, you know, a lot of people were involved in this were not sort of seasoned activists who had done this before. I'd been arrested before in these kinds of situations, although not for anything really serious. I was later charged with these serious felonies that were complete horseshit, and then they were dismissed, but four people are still facing them. But your thought was that only your experience in that evening, I guess it was in early October, was it of 2011, was it only one person stayed that night?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, only one person stayed, and I give him credit, you know, that
guy. Did he stay for long after that, you know, or was it just that night?
Him?
Yeah.
I think he stayed for the first week. I think he eventually lost. No, I think he stayed for a couple weeks, but I think he fell out of touch. I think that I don't know. I never asked him why he stopped coming, but...
But you came back afterward, even though you made a statement.
I was there for 4 months.
And you did come back after that first night. You may have left the first night, but you came back.
I came back early that morning, and later joined him and other people.
Did structures go up immediately, do you know, or was there a delay, or what was significant about the first few days?
Well, I do think structures went up within the first couple of days. I seem to recall within the first week we had several teepees. Within the first 2 weeks we had a dome. And within, you know, by the end of the 2 weeks, I recall us having a whole village. Mm-hmm. You know, it was beautiful. And within 3 weeks, I think we had a kitchen. And we had a whole village right there. And we had radios and, you know, we had... Once we realized that they were going to try to out us, we had an intelligence gathering crew that would go around on a nightly basis and try to identify where the cops were and where they were and how many cops there were on duty in order to identify whether or not they had numbers to move us, and who we had to keep awake and who we should keep on call. And in that regard, we were very organized, or at least there was an effort amongst some of the people to be organized. But in other areas, we totally fell out of organization.
Mm-hmm. So what were the, you know, was there much outreach to the community in this at this time? Was there much division of labor in the camp in terms of people, you know, taking different tasks?
You know, we had working groups, and people who wanted to work worked. Eventually, people got very upset because as our encampment started filling up with more
homeless people,
although I don't like that word.
Unhoused, urban migrants.
Because, you know, look, I've lived in my car for 3 years. In fact, I was working as a security guard, and I was still living in my car. Mm-hmm. I know plenty of homeless people, people who are living in their vehicles, people who, you know, sleep outside, who are able to maintain completely normal lives. Although it's much harder, and you have to have friends, and you have to have a place to take showers. I think the proper word would be people who are dealing with addiction issues. You know, we had a lot of people who were coming to our encampment who obviously had serious addiction issues. And those people made it hard. Made it hard because we started having multiple jobs, and they were expecting us to take care of them. They were often very rude. They often demanded to be fed. And the reality is they didn't necessarily want to help maintain the encampment. They didn't necessarily want to help do the working part. And I think that's...
And stay tuned. Don't go away. It looks like a brief pause here.
So you're saying that there was a division of feeling about this particular group you're concerned about?
Yeah, yes. I mean, there were some people who understood that these people were disenfranchised and that they maybe felt some responsibility to take care of them. But even amongst those who felt that way, eventually, you know, they tired. As you know, it's very hard sometimes for people who haven't suffered from major addiction issues and being homeless to understand that, you know, 4 months is not the period of time it takes to reform. You know, it's huge, and the amount of time it really takes to fight that addiction, you know, is a huge period of time. It often takes years and years and years. And, you know, some of us didn't realize, you know, how much effort, how much care, and how much, you know, real medical assistance these people needed.
And before we hear more about addiction problems and divisions in the Occupy camp in Santa Cruz in the fall of 2011, let's say hello to caller Punch 'em Out, Pat Colby. Hey there, Pat.
Oh, no, I'm Punch 'em Out, not Take 'em Out.
Well, whatever.
I just wanted to update. Last time I called, I was talking about how to a problem with an OD patient between County Mental Health and the Emmeline Clinic and also partially due to the DEA wanting people to go off opiates at the Emmeline Clinic and I guess Women's Health Center and HP, all the places that are Medi-Cal only, are dropping people off their opiates, and I've been working with someone who is being dropped off too quickly. And so her experience yesterday was she went into the hospital because she was going into withdrawals, and she was really sick, and she was vomiting yellow stuff. And they called over to the MLN clinic, and the doctor misinformed them and told them that on April 29th, she had written a script for 70 more of this hydro, it's called Zolotin. It's a really powerful opiate for real severe disabling pain. Said that she had just given this person 70 more on the 29th, which was, in fact, not true. She wrote a prescription. Nobody called me as the advocate nor the client to tell them there was this prescription waiting, and they couldn't understand why we didn't pick it up. That's one of the stories I'm hearing. The other story is she wrote it for the 29th for us to pick up today when we had our appointment at 10 a.m., So there's two different stories, which usually means when you have two different stories that conflict each other, that it seems like somebody's trying to cover up. So in the meantime, the hospital called the patient a liar, discharged her, didn't give her any medical care for anything, and then they threatened to have her arrested by the sheriff if she didn't leave. They were going to have her arrested for loitering. So this is getting out of hand where they're refusing treatment. I just had a request to the doctor to ask for some treatment for the anxiety that the hospital had gave her just a few pills of that had helped, and also some medicine that would help with the, this is going back to withdrawals from addiction, the sweating problem and the chills. And the hospital had given her something, but they'd only given her one pill and not a prescription. So I asked the doctor for a prescription for that, and the doctor outright refused to treat her for that.
What was the name of the doctor, Pat?
Dr. Brooks at the MLN clinic. Mm-hmm. I believe her first name is Robin. Dr. Robin Brooks. So far as I can see, I definitely wouldn't recommend her as a doctor because she isn't supervising this poor woman. It's almost... I told my brother it sounds like cruelty. I think that they're trying to just upset this person that I advocate for and hope she'll just leave because they've done a lot of inappropriate medical treatment. And at this point, I want to make sure that they're all held accountable. Some of the doctors in the ER have been willing to try to help the situation because this person isn't alone. From what I'm getting talking to different places that I volunteer that are around with the homeless people, that there's 100-plus people that this is being done to. And so a lot of them are turning to street heroin, and they're not getting help from their doctors. They're not getting help from the ER. And then, of course, if they're doing heroin, they're getting arrested. And since they can't afford the thing because they're usually poor, the heroin thing, they're going to turn to doing other criminal activities such as dealing drugs or stealing things to buy the drugs, selling them their bodies for sex to buy these drugs. I mean, it's like they take these people that were stabilized and they turn their world upside down. I've been trying to find rehab. I feel that was really negligent and reckless to take people off opiates without having rehab lined up, real supervised rehab for these people. Because they're not treating them with the medicines that they need for the symptoms of the withdrawal, and they're not putting them in rehab or supervising them. And this is, it's like I'm going around in a circle because this doctor's trying to make it seem like she's giving a certain amount, she doubled the medicine up, but then nobody ever called to tell us there was a prescription, so I asked for the double of the medicine, and they refused to do it. So where I ended with the administrator is I said, okay, fine, I'm going to call you in a week, and I'm going to have you check the computer to see if this doctor wrote another phony. I'm sorry that I'm calling it a phony prescription because she never intended for it to be filled, and we'll pick up this amount for that week. And then, of course, I'm going to get a changing story that she only writes prescriptions for every 2 weeks, which is what she's been doing in the past. So, you know, it's just really frustrating, and I really hope to find more people. I need to find another four people that are being affected this way and treated this way by the hospitals and the doctors so that I can do a pattern and practice complaint with the Department of Health and Human Services, because this is really terrible. This is going to cost people their lives, their freedom. You know, they might OD on the heroin. They could, you know, end up arrested for stealing. I mean, it's outrageous what they're doing to homeless and poor people.
Can you
do this,
Pat? Can you reiterate exactly what it is that Dr. Brooks or the other doctors are doing that is a deceptive or inadequate practice? I'm a little bit unclear on that.
Well, there's a couple things. The first thing is, okay, the person I'm talking about was getting 8 milligrams by lot. It's hypomorphine a day. And so within a month, she had cut her down to 5, to one-third of it. And this person is constantly going through a roller coaster of withdrawal symptoms. And so she's been going to the emergency room, and the emergency room is treating her for the withdrawals and giving her minimal, but they are giving her some of the dilatins to get her through that day. But they're also getting frustrated because it's not their job to supervise and treat. It's really her doctor, Dr. Brooks. So that is really reckless. One doctor stated, of course you won't say it on the record, that it was really unrealistic to expect to cut people, not give them diarrhea or nausea medicine, not to give them medicine for the chills and the sweats, not to supervise them in a facility, but to have them do it on the street, or this person's in a month-to-month motel room. But, of course, this doctor would never come out and say that. And some of the doctors, this was the most caring doctor that really was honest about the situation. It's a really bad situation because opiate withdrawal, they say it won't kill you, but it can kill you, because if you're already disabled and incapacitated, and then you take away the pain medication that makes these people so that they're functional and mobile, then they dehydrate. They lay in bed, they can't get food, so they starve, they can't get liquids, so they get more dehydrated, and they could just die in their bed. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they're finding people just dead in their cars or somewhere. From what I hear, it's hard to get a record of it, but at the homeless service center, that there's people dying in their cars around there or on the lot constantly. There's no way to get public records just being hidden by the hospital, Dominican, and the homeless service centers about how many people are just dying. And I wouldn't be surprised if it has to do with this.
Have you attempted to get those records from the Homeless Lack of Services Center?
We've attempted to get records from the county. We've attempted to get records from the hospital, the Stonewall. The county council, which is the county attorneys, have said it will take a deposit of $800, because they're going to have to do this electronic search for 4.5 hours at $113 an hour. And usually when they do this, when they make it so expensive that nobody will be able to afford to do it, then they're hiding the records. And unless you have money for a FOIA attorney to call them on it, they'll continue to do these ways of having closed and non-transparent government.
Well, you know, we had some problems getting records of about half a decade ago from the courts for sleeping ban court actions. And actually, deputies tried to block us, arrest us, you know, accuse us of this and that, throw us out for trespassing. And we simply said, you know, do what you want. We just kept showing up with video cameras, and they eventually faded away. First day they had
right.
5 deputies, and they had 2. Next
Did
day
you ever was, get the records, though?
Yeah, only a little at a time. You know, they didn't
right.
want to, but, you know, they did begin to give us the records, and we were beginning to go through them in terms of, you know, it's really kind of abusive. Courts can be even worse often
it's
than...
It's not open and transparent,
courts,
obviously.
Courts can be even worse than, you know, the... other public agencies, because the courts are not a, you know, subject to the Public Records Act and
right,
on the state
they're
level.
Under different rules, because they can claim that it's part of a ongoing court case or part of an investigation.
No, no, that's you're thinking of police records, but court record. I'm not sure what the reason is they claim, but they anyway. So it does require something of a hassle. But you know, regarding you know getting information from. Seeing if the problem is more widespread, as you suggest it is, of course, you need, you know, like some doctor who's going to tipster, you know, a deep throat doctor, or you need to set up a table outside Emmeline and invite people to come and tell their stories.
Right, because I need at least four more victims to go forward with the case. And so I'm outreaching to people. I volunteer at a really great cause. It's called the Sunrise Cafe. And it's Tuesday morning at 4, Thursday morning at 4, and Saturday morning at 4. And it goes till 9 a.m. We have food, and people can sleep in a darkened room. It's just a real friendly atmosphere. They get to relax, feel safe, not be harassed or abused, get to eat something. And so from what I'm hearing about them, they all know about the opiate cutoff program and the lack of medical care to make sure that people don't die or go through the withdrawals properly or don't turn to street drugs instead. And so I'm hoping that eventually I can get some names, because what I'm getting from all this volunteering, and of course, you know, I volunteer with Huff and I do cop watching downtown for different vendors and performers, and I'm getting about, there's about at least 100, if not more, people that they've done this.
Well, I know that we also talked about, you know, you're going to the city attorney's office to try to get a disability dispensation for yourself so that you can table downtown without having to move the table every hour. Any new word on that?
Nope. Still haven't heard a thing from him. I'll probably, I asked that I hear from him within 5 business days. It's been long over 5 business days now. So I figure I'll give him another 5 business days, and then it's time to, you know, call him on his illegal action of not making reasonable accommodation or even responding to a request for reasonable accommodation.
What I'd do is I'd simply send it to him as an email and reiterate it and say, did you receive this, and are you going to be responding to it?
Yeah, or when are you?
You know, and the point being that, you know, a hard copy is somewhat harder to document online than an email, although, you know, you can always scan in a copy of the hard copy.
Right, and I do have viewer with me when I made her time stamp it and date stamp it received.
Right.
Receptionist. So they couldn't deny, because that's another game that they play to hide records.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I find when they're playing games to hide records, it's because they've done something illegal or fraud or something totally
so
incorrect.
So, Pat, I also know that you... you've been occasionally getting street reports, and you're going to be passing those in various, I don't know, video or audio clips on so to those of us who know how to post on IndieBay, although it shouldn't be hard to teach you how to do that, too. So
well, I know how to do it. It's just getting the software to make it a quick file,
a quick time file,
and then I'll be able to easily upload it to YouTube. I've got footage of those terrible street performers making a lot of noise. Beautiful, enjoyable noise. I've got an artist that makes wire wrap jewelry like nothing I've ever seen. He's from Spain. I've got video of the terrible scarf lady that beautiful rainbow of scarves brighten up this downtown, you know, these criminals. And so I want people to see what the city council is trying to cheat them out of. We have this really great flavor downtown Santa Cruz, and they're trying to sterilize it and take it away without the citizens' approval.
Thank you, Pat. Anything else?
I want to bring up one other thing.
Go ahead.
I did go in for the first meeting with one of my clients for the 180-180 program. Mm-hmm. She's kind of a special case, but she already does have a voucher ready and waiting, so they're not going to need to get her one. And I have to say that the two people I worked with were really nice. One of the person's name was Robin. I didn't get his last name, but he says he's been doing this for quite a while. And so what they do is they get all the information they can, get your credit report, get all your references. So they go and seek out the landlord. So they talk to the landlord first to approach them on a Section 8. And they do all that legwork first and, you know, match you up with needs. And then they have you come in later. So they do all this negotiation. So far, the intake, I was really pleased. They were real caring. And all the questions were really good. And I'm hoping that this will work for my client to get her out of her motel and to get her back into an apartment so she can take her stuff out of storage and start living again. She was homeless with these severe disabilities. She's sleeping on the ground. She got stuff ripped off from her. She just recently let a stranger in her room. She thought the person was okay, and they just stole her iPhone. So, you know, it's like this homeless life that everyone says is free and just fun, you know, a free ride. It's not free, and it's not fun. It's full of a lot of terrible things that happen to these people. And a lot of the people are disabled, and society's just kind of let them down, because when you get disabled, it's not called a free ride because you pay as you work into disability insurance. And, you know, God help anyone that has to use disability insurance, but it's a benefit that you pay for. It's not welfare. When you're on disability insurance, you can't get food stamps. So there aren't all these free give-outs, and you live below the poverty level, and you're stuck in situations where there's a lot of abuse going on and from landlords and different situations, living around criminals and drug dealers and gangbangers. So I'm hoping this 180-180 program will come through for my client and get her finally placed after.
Do you have any information, Pat, on whether 180 is actually opening up new housing or whether it is... there's been some concern that people who are previously on these Section 8 lists are getting pushed back in favor of different people.
I do have information on that. My brother did a lot of public records on what's happening, which is not right. I mean, it's great that they're trying to help these 180 people, but what they're doing is they're not giving out vouchers to people that are disabled or families on the Section 8 voucher list. So they're having to wait. Their list is closed and not moving, and they're filling these 180s first. So that's discriminatory. And so my brother has been looking into that fraud, and he's got a paper trail of evidence showing that from his public records. We're trying to get a media interested in doing a story on this, because this is fraud against everyone that... I myself am sitting on that Section 8 voucher list. I've been on there for like 8 years now, and it's not moving because they're giving preferential, which is illegal discrimination, treatment to these other people. We're all in a big bind.
So what? Who are the other people?
Well, families that needed disabled people that are on the Section 8 voucher list. What they're doing is they're doing these 180 when they should have funded brand new 180 vouchers for this program. Instead, they're stealing it from the regular voucher list.
So who's making the choices about who gets preferential treatment at the top of the list?
Now, that's a good question. We're trying to figure out how they're choosing it. There seems to be no consistent pattern to who they're choosing. And, of course, trying to get public records, they're not forthcoming. It's like, it seems like which way the wind blows, or if they like you or they dislike you. They told one single mother that she had to be disabled, and she's physically and mentally disabled, but they said she had to have a mental disability. She did have it. She had both. And then they told this other person that is had schizophrenia, that he had to be elderly to be on the 180. So there's all these different stories going around to disqualify people. So it's pretty much... A lot of it's going from the most consistent story I've heard is it seems like they're giving houses to people that the vendors downtown and the stores, the businesses, don't like being so visible downtown, that they're annoying to them. Like maybe they come in and steal too much. So those people might be getting treatment. And also there's nepotism and cronyism as to who's...
Now, do you know this? On what basis do you say this? Are you speculating, or do you actually have some vendors who've come to you and said, yeah, this is what we're doing, or some source inside?
Well, there's information of people that are... know this is going on, and they're very upset about it.
I'm sorry, information... wait a minute. What? When you say people who know this is going on, what are you talking about?
Who are part of these programs that know...
So you're talking to someone who's inside the 180-180 program? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, or part of the Homeless Service Center, or on the city council.
So they're claiming that the 180...
government.
So they're claiming that the 180-180 program is selecting people who merchants want to get out of sight.
Right. Instead of people that need this housing the most.
Hmm.
So there is no rhyme or reason at this point, and they aren't forthcoming with how they're choosing. We just happen to... We had advocated with Ken Cole, who is the head of the Housing Authority of Santa Cruz County, and my brother appealed to him, and suddenly our client got a voucher out of nowhere, had it for over a year. They're not giving it up. In fact, they've continued it for another 90 days, and so somebody suggested using the 180-180 resource to find her a place. So they're really working hard to find her a place.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there, Pat.
Yeah.
Thank you for the lengthy report, and I don't know, keep up the good.
I wish I could produce evidence on some things, but there's thousands of pages of records.
You've done a fine job so far. We'll be looking for more evidence in the future.
Okay, well, thank you, and thanks for letting me bring this up on your show.
Sure, thanks for bringing it up.
I can tell there's frustration in my voice over all of this.
Yeah, I hear you. Bye-bye. And call-in lines are open. 427-3772 is the call-in number. You are tuned to 101.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are free. We are unlicensed, unapologetic, and some would say unsanitary, but I would dispute that. I'm happy to take your phone calls if you want to call into the studio. 427-3772. My 2 hours of topics from 6 to 8 usually covers homeless civil rights and services issues. And also I do interviews from the street with a variety of folks. We were talking with, I believe his name is Chris, back on April 1st, the day I was arrested for making an audio recording of a Santa Cruz City Council meeting from the wrong place, where I've been making the recording for the last 25 years. The discussion here is about the Occupy movement and the encampment set up by Occupy Santa Cruz, the village set up there, its successes, its failures, and how it ran. Let's hear a little more.
Gastric assistance, and you know, I think there was a lot of naivety that led to, a bunch of disgruntled people, and I think that create divisions. So we had internal divisions, and we had external divisions about how to deal with the external government of Santa Cruz coming on us, basically, starting to close on to us. And, you know, I think when you had internal strife and you had external strife, that put a lot of stress on our movement, and people started breaking away into their own little groups. And I think that was the beginning of the end of the movement.
Now, there was actually there were two segments to the physical segments to the area where people were engaging in Occupy. One was in front of the courthouse, which is where there was a small wigwam, or what would you call it, and a number of small structures and a lot of signs, and people would have their general assembly there usually every day. Then there was the larger area in San Lorenzo Park that was adjacent to it, that part of the San Lorenzo Park that bordered on this area, and that had a large encampment of people of different kinds. Actually, since there's no homeless shelter in Santa Cruz that takes care of more than 5% of the population, a lot of people came there. People came from out of jail. People came from different areas in the country and stayed there. And, you know, although I heard a lot of different complaints, my general take about the safety of the area was it was compared, let's say, to the death rate or problem rate throughout Santa Cruz generally for individuals, it was far less for that entire group of people that were together. And, I mean, there were problems, definitely, with so many people together. And they may say some people were big drinkers, others were users of... And it's not so much that they used medication, it's that if there were conflicts that developed, and they did for different reasons. But And this went on for 2 months, as I remember it. Like, it began in early October, and it was the campground in front of the courthouse was shut down on December 4th in front of the in San Lorenzo on December 8th. That was 3 days after, 4 or 5 days after the Wells Fargo Bank building, the leased vacant bank, was occupied as a potential community center, homeless center, protest against Wells Fargo. I guess it had a number of different functions. Any thoughts on that whole thing?
I feel that, you know, I was watching a small documentary on the Occupy Movement last night, and
Brent Adams documentary prep?
No. Actually, I was watching a segment from The Daily Show.
Oh, okay.
And they were joking about how in Zuccotti Park there was a class system amongst their own Occupy Movement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had the kids from Yale and Harvard, and then you had the much larger group that contained drifters and, you know, other homeless people, and how this created divisions because the various groups weren't working together, and many people were commenting on how the rich kids, the kids who came from, you know, well-off universities, were starting to make decisions for everyone that weren't necessarily democratically agreed upon.
Did you notice the same thing in Santa Cruz?
And yes, I guess to a degree I felt that there was that same vibe. I mean, I think that everyone, you know, when you have people who come from families that often have drug issues and who didn't necessarily finish high school, and then you have other people who are avid readers and who are well educated. Yes, you know, often there's that inability for the more educated people to empathize with the lack of, you know, the lack of skills in that department that, you know, our homeless group necessarily had. And I think this created, you know, this feeling that we were governing them, and I think it created a lot of resentment within that community. I think that you had a bunch of people of a bunch of different backgrounds who weren't necessarily able to see the other person's point of view. And yes, this is, you know, essentially, unfortunately, the same issues that emerged in our society became the exact same issues that emerged in our movement. And our own inability, one, to accept that we even have those issues, and two, our inability to deal with them, I think, really hurt us. And I think it's unfortunate.
Well, you know, I mean, again, I don't know. I was only more of a reporter and sort of a, I came and made, you know, gave out flyers and talked to people and interviewed people and reported on the radio and was a supporter of the Occupy Movement, but it was rarely there. I was there the first night or two off in the park. I think the first night we moved to San Lorenzo Park, I was there. But didn't usually spend my time down there at night. I try to be there in solidarity at different points. But I think my impression was the reason that the problems that you know, the main problems the Occupy Movement had there were the police and the authorities that, you know, first they insisted on people getting a permit, then they started shrinking the campground. I mean, there was the confrontation at in the bank building, the leased and empty and vacant bank building, and that maybe provided a flashpoint and a pretext for the police to move on the encampment generally, but I think that they were trying to do that anyway. It was happening throughout the country, and I don't think it was. I really don't feel it's. I wouldn't blame, however much I might disagree with the tactics of taking over a bank building. I wouldn't agree. You know, I wouldn't hold these people responsible. I think it's, you know, it was the decision of the police department and the sheriffs and maybe even other broader agencies that we don't have a lot of information about to crack down, and I hope that they're not coming to crack down on us. No, that's just the siren in the distance. So that's my thought on it.
Yeah, you know, I guess I would... I mean, look, when you look in other countries, and you look especially in countries where a larger portion of the citizenship, the populace, has some form of military training, you see that the external police forces really have a lack of ability to deal with those protesters. I mean, if you look in Turkey, and in Turkey, a much larger portion of the people have military training than Americans, and you actually looked at, you know, the police's ability to deal with them, police had very little ability. The reality is the protesters had the up on the police
for a while, but then they went. Then the square was abandoned.
Eventually, but they moved to other places. It became a huge nationwide thing throughout Turkey.
But it stopped. It hasn't. At least it hasn't been in the media for the last 3 months. You know that it has been going on. We don't know about it.
I haven't been keeping this track on it as much as I'd want to. But I mean, even if we look in other parts of the world, you know,
I mean, there's still an encampment in the Ukraine.
Yeah, in Ukraine. In the camp in the Ukraine's, you know, huge.
It's going on, even though the sympathizers of the encampment have taken over the government, you know, and there's a big Western support of that government as a sort of a pawn, I think, in the East-West stuff. But although that encampment is characterized by some as being extremely right-wing.
You know, I mean, they have different definitions for what right-wing is and what left-wing is than Americans do.
Anti-Semitic, very nationalistic.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. The Ukraine, the Eastern Europe has its own issues, and I don't really want to go into that. But my whole point isn't necessarily, because I think that, you know, when you look into training, you look into, you know, military training, intelligence training, it's a bunch of tools. It's a bunch of tools, and who decides and how you decide to utilize it determines what happens. But anyone who wants to be efficient at revolting against the authorities, or rather freeing themselves from being oppressed in our economic system, I think needs some of that training. And I think that, you know, they need a lot more than that. I think it's only a small portion of a much larger curriculum that we need if we want to be able to do this again, if we want to be able to, you know, bring back a movement that can really, really take over and really offer alternative solutions. I mean, the police force are there to keep the status quo in many ways. And unless we know how to deal with them, unless we know how to evade them, unless we know how to outsmart them, the reality is they're just going to get us again. The reality is we're just going to get shut down again. We need to learn how to deal with our military government in a way that enables us to survive it.
It's almost, I mean, it sounds like a kind of a libertarian, it sounds like frankly, a sort of authoritarian. I mean, military training.
What I mean by...
I'm not sure what you mean, but
that,
mean weapons training?
No, not necessarily weapons training. What I mean is by military training, I mean, you know, where you learn how to spot social psychology, you learn the tools of the police force. In one of my classes that I'm taking, I'm learning about how police control a crowd, how they look at the crowd and they identify leaders, they identify provocateurs, they identify aggravators. They break everybody up into different profiles. And then what they do is they look and they determine, they make judgments on how to control the crowd, whether show of force is the best way to do it, whether to draw a leader out and try to control that leader, you know, whether they need to make random arrests. I mean, really, that is what the classes call it, random arrest, in order to control or intimidate the larger group. You know, those are various tools that police forces learn in order to contain groups. If you're a group and you don't know those tools, you're going to be controlled by them. You know, if you don't know the tools of the trade for an army or a corporation or anything that you're going up against, they're going to be able to play you. They're going to be able to just throw you around like a rag doll.
So maybe some seminars and what to expect might be good in future occupations.
I really think the best thing to do would be to start an online curriculum where we find various FBI and CIA and police training videos from, you know, from the 80s, declassified stuff that's not necessarily criminal to publish. You know, stuff public domain? Yeah, public domain. You know, like find public domain stuff and create like an online curriculum where we show people, one, how to create quick some fast encampments. We have various classes. We don't have to be violent to deal with a violent force, but we do have to evade it. Sometimes people in the movement didn't understand how the police force worked, and they left individuals up to dealing, to helping themselves. With this, you can observe in some of the videos of the Occupy movement, where the police would have a very small group. You know, for instance, I was watching in Oakland, and there were times where the police had, you know, the police, every weapon, every group, every military has a set of rules in which it must operate by. And by rules, I don't mean moral rules. I mean certain physical rules. Like, for instance, the police force has this limitation. It's called money. You know, they have to be able to employ a certain number of police in order to deal with anything, with any one incident. If you have an incident that's being intelligently controlled, like the Occupy movement, has the ability to draw the police force. They have to exert that, they have to spend that money and spend a portion of that budget, and then when the police are coming to them, to evade. And by evading, they're not going to get arrested that one night, and the police are going to have spent that money, they're going to have spent the emotional energy, and the police will be lower in resources. By becoming akin to this, then you can go, okay, now we're going to make it appear that we're going to occupy this park. So the police go to that park, right? But they exert the resources, and they don't get the cost. They don't get
the consequences they want.
The consequences they want, exactly. But they have spent their resources. So, you know, what ends up happening is you're able to force your opponent to have to play by your rules. So, for instance, the Occupy movement, we couldn't have been violent to the extent the police were. That's okay. You don't have to be violent. What you do have to is you have to force your opponent to determine that it's cheaper, it's more cost effective to work with you and to come to some sort of treaty or peace than it is to work against you. If the governing government thinks that it's cheaper to just move you aside and it's possible, they'll do it. But if they realize that it's cheaper just to silence you by giving you what you want, they will do that. You know, we had to force them into, because we had to force them into a situation in which they were more willing to work with us. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were
suggestions that the camp move, and I guess there was a lot of talk about, although very little action around, yeah, once the camp was dispersed, coming back at other times. People did, to some extent, briefly come back, but nobody came back to stay, or very few.
What I mean by leaving and coming back is I mean like having mobile encampments. The police are not as mobile as we could have been. Yes, in that particular, within the occupation, the reality is police often had the mobile factor on us. But they didn't have to. The reality is they had tons of bureaucracy that they had to go through for any one particular action. But we didn't. Or we didn't have to. So, for instance,
what there was the consensus problem.
That minor thing. But, a minor thing. What I mean is, like, so let's say that part of, like, an online curriculum taught occupiers how to create spontaneous, quick encampments, mobile encampments, encampments that could be put up within, you know, an hour and brought down, right? So, you know, let's say a group of people learn how to do that, like any military.
Was it done anywhere else in the country that you know of, or has it been done elsewhere in the world that you know of?
Well, yeah, the military acts this way. The, you know,
non-military people, though. Has it been done in any of the Egypt, Tunisia, Bahrain, Turkey, Ukraine? I don't know.
I don't know.
Usually people occupy a sort of a static spot. Guerrilla movements but they're armed. You know, that's a little different.
Yeah. You know, and no, I don't. And this is, but, you know, the United States is a very unique situation. The United States is a place, we're not currently a state where we need a violent revolution, but we do need a revolution that can force our government into certain concessions. So,
what concessions are you seeking?
Concessions I would seek would be, okay, so if you could, you know, start to do that, start to occupy areas mobily and do it rapidly, continuously alternating between different parks, until eventually the police force tires and then is unable to keep up with you and starts creating concessions, you would end up occupying large areas that you would probably be given by the city, and you would turn those into urban camps, eventually with, you know, media centers, educational centers, you know, so you would have, you would be on your way to creating a class-free zone. A zone, little urban villages where for the first time in people's lives, people aren't waking up asking themselves, what bills do I have to pay and what do I have to not do to be doomed economically, but actually ask themselves the more important question, the question that, you know, in our greatest sci-fis like Star Trek, citizens of like the Federation wake up asking themselves, which is, what can I do to make the best out of myself today? You know, and class-free zones that I think would have been the best concession offer that we could have been offered and we could have, you know, asked for, would have been places that would have been the frontier of that. You know, if America is so great, perhaps we should be the first country to venture into class-free zones. Real villages where you come, you know...
Didn't we mow down those villages when we arrived, like, 300 years ago?
Yes, we did, didn't we? We fucking did. And we, you know, we desperately...
Give them smallpox blankets and things.
Yeah, we did. That's really true.
You know, yeah, regarding the kinds of these suggestions you have about different tactics for organizing and dispersing and tiring the opponent and by, you know, mobile activity and so forth, I think there's a lot of... The Sub Rosa has a lot of sort of different texts suggested by, I don't know, Italian activists from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and other activists. I'm not an expert on that, but I mean, I've seen what appears to be those.
Yeah, I think Sub Rosa has gotten rid of a lot of that stuff.
Oh, really?
I think Sub Rosa is very paranoid. Every single time I've gone in there and tried to talk to them.
Well, you're a little anxious yourself. I mean,
I'm a little anxious. Yeah, no, yeah. Definitely. I mean, I'm a little paranoid. I kind of have this general rule, which is it's best to have two identities.
And yet you are being candid and speaking on the air.
Yeah.
Although anonymously, but still. Somebody wanted to say, I heard that guy's voice, you know.
Yes. I mean, I feel like...
I think it's really important that people do speak out the way you do. I mean, but again, you know, I'm not currently employed and risking my employment. I actually had an interview with another person about another issue entirely, about the homeless lack of services center, as I call it. She was employed there, and she wanted to talk about the kind of bullshit that was going on and how things had gone to pot and so forth. And she would give a very interesting interview, but then she called me later and said, can you hold it until I get another job? And this was 5 years ago that this happened.
Like, one, I don't care that much about my job.
Of course, she gave her name.
Yeah, and I want to give my name.
We're going to pause briefly because we have a caller calling in to comment. Hi, caller.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I was just listening to the interview with the person talking about, you know, the Occupy movement and what needs to be done. And I think on simple demands, you know, I have a lot of respect for the young people that got involved with the Occupy movement because, I mean, there must be a real sense of frustration among young people in this country, you know, who are concerned about society. But I think, I mean, on basic demands, jobs for $15 an hour, more vacation for people that work, really, you know, but I think that, you know, I think that the fact that the unions and the big unions have failed so miserably in explaining to young people, you know, that, you know, work doesn't have to be, you know, drudgery for nothing, that, you know, that there is a history of workers who, you know, who had specific demands for reforms that did actually make life much better. You know, I mean, I think back to my father and his union job really created a really nice lifestyle for us as far as free time. And I, you know, compared, you know, his lifestyle to the fathers of my friends that weren't in unions, you know, and the salesmen, you know, who worked 70 hours a week and never had vacation. But as far as the Occupy movement, also anti-war. I mean, it's obvious that if we don't stop this government and its imperialist ambitions, that, I mean, it's going to be one catastrophe after another, and the society is going to become more and more militarized, and we're going to have more crazy veterans coming back that need to be taken care of for the rest of their lives, mentally and physically. And it's a media reform, which is really, I mean, now with the internet, there's much more possibility of communication, you know, between people who, it was really interesting to see the live video feeds from some of the Occupy movement.
Now, were you yourself part of the Occupy movement?
No.
Did you show up?
No, I wasn't.
And were you in Santa Cruz when this was all happening, or were you elsewhere?
I was elsewhere. Yeah.
But you're now in Santa Cruz, or are you calling from
outside? No, I'm not. I'm listening on the internet right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad someone's listening. I'll tell you that. What part of the country are you from, if I may ask?
I'm from New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And you've called before, this is your first?
Yes, I have called before.
Okay. Yeah. I remember, somebody calling in from Jersey, and probably was you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find your upstate interview is really interesting, and... all the interviews.
You know, it's particularly interesting for us here. Today there were, two articles appeared. One is a proposal by activist politician Steve Plaich, who wants to see a nighttime moratorium on the camping ban for a year on all ordinances involving camping, during the nighttime hours. And there's a lot of discussion on that on Santa Cruz Indie Media. If anybody wants to go check it out, yourself included, caller, that's indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. And then there's also, in the current issue of the Good Times, advertising throwaway ate up the Santa Cruz Weekly Combine. It's kind of our weekly garbage liner. They have a story on the Sanctuary Camp by Jake Pierce, not one of my favorite writers, about Brent Adams' attempt to, his recent, compares the Sanctuary Camp proposal that he has with Opportunity Village in Eugene, which is a small, I don't know how small it is. I haven't researched it, and it isn't really mentioned in the article. But it's interesting to contrast this with the large, vibrant Occupy campground that happened in Santa Cruz during the fall of 2011. Let me give you the last word, though, because I'm going to roll. But
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was listening, and I as far as Occupy, and you know, and I think something like it will happen again. I mean, I don't see why not. I mean, things haven't changed much. It's pretty miserable here in the USA. But I think we need to be more anti-war and start saying it and expressing
big
it.
Big time, yeah,
and,
sure.
More specific demands.
In fact, Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs was proposing back in 2010 that we set up encampments at federal buildings at the beginning of every month to demand an end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and many other places that the Obamadoids are doing their warring on the money of the rest of the country.
It's rather unbearable for any reasonable person to watch this unfold over and over again. But,
Well, listen, thank you for calling. I'm going to roll, but appreciate your calling. Please keep listening, keep calling. Thanks again, man.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye.
And you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert. This is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. You're able to call in if you want, 427-3772. And we're listening to some interviews from early April, April 1st, in fact, the day after, well, the evening I was arrested for tape recording with this very, probably this very tape recorder that I'm looking at in the studio and playing from. And there's going to be more opportunity for arrest coming up on Tuesday evening when there is actually going to be a discussion of, I hardly want to call it a reform proposal, but it's a proposal supposedly to respond to the shrinking sidewalk ordinance. I'm going to be talking about that next as soon as this particular segment of tape is over. So stay tuned and stay near your phones if you want to be a part of this discussion.
But, you know, to look, when I got involved in the Occupy movement, I did it because I was trying to make a retirement for myself. I was trying to create a future for myself. I, you know, really believe that if we can't change the course of this country, we're not going to be able to give anything to our children or our children's children. So I'm thinking about the long-term perspective, which is, you know, from my view, not occupying, not doing this, you're taking a much greater risk. Yes, maybe there's a more immediate risk for your personal safety, but who cares, you know, and I know as biological creatures, we care a lot about our immediate risk, but, you know, I think from a critical perspective, if you're able to remove yourself from your emotional angst, you'll see that if we can't do this, there's a much greater risk, and it's coming for all of us. And, you know, how can one ethically, how can one, you know, perpetuate the species if we have nothing to give it to? You know, how I want to be able to have children. I want to have children, so I want a country to give my children to.
Here, here. You were going to give me 20 minutes. We're going on half an hour. Do you want to?
Yeah, we can keep on going. So, you know, I feel that this is what occupiers have to do. Yeah. Basically, you know, contact former federal agents, former cops. During the when I was part of the Occupy movement, I was listening to, there was a night where I spent the night listening to a lecture from a former cop, one of the most decorated undercover cops in the Bay Area, who's a huge opponent of the war on drugs. He wrote this huge book about why the war on drugs has been a complete failure.
San Jose guy?
Yeah, he's a San Jose guy, and he's, you know, he's incredibly intelligent, and he says he saw more corruption in those beginning years of the war on drugs than he'd ever seen as a cop. You know, and he's like, look, man, you're a cop, you come into a room full of $100 bills packed at the top, you're in financial trouble, like, you're going to become corrupt. You know, we're placing decent people, you know, there's a lot of decent cops, there's a lot of corrupt cops too, and there's a lot of assholes, but, you know, there's some decent ones, and, you know, you're placing them in an undecent situation.
Speaking as a security guard.
Yes. You're placing them in an undecent situation. And yes, people are going to become corrupt. You're going to, you know, it's going to destroy your police force. It's going to destroy your government. The war on drugs took the value of drugs, escalated it, and it put normal individuals in unnormal and unreasonable situations, and then it became surprised that it caused corruption. The people who ran it became surprised that they were causing so much corruption. So, you know, I know there's people like him, I don't recall his name right now, but, you know, there's plenty of people that would really want to teach us, that do teach their own students who aren't police officers how to operate in a way that keeps them safe and in a way that wakes them up, you know? I mean, you know, as one begins to learn this way of thinking, I think one starts realizing that, you know, our entertainment industry is a huge distraction that our imperialist government uses to keep us, to have us become softened and compliant. And, you know, instead of people really asking themselves the serious questions and just simply getting up and taking back their country, they spend their nights on Facebook, and they feel content because they decide to post something that's liberal, you know, rather than really getting up and fighting and doing what's necessary to take back their own country. I mean, that's a very disturbed and very compliant compliant populace. You know, I'm still upset that during that summer of the Occupy Movement, a lot of our youth, a lot of my...
Summer after or the summer before?
The summer during the Occupy Movement.
Well, the Occupy Movement started in October of 2011.
Okay, well...
I mean, that's when I remember Occupy Wall Street.
Okay,
maybe in September.
I still felt like... Yeah, it started... I remember it starting in September.
Yeah, possible.
But, you know...
In Santa Cruz, it was in October.
Yeah. But, you know, basically, during that season, a lot of people my own age decided to go to festivals during the end of summer, the beginning of fall.
Burning Man person.
You know, Burning Man type people. Yeah, instead of coming in and joining their generation's revolution, you know, and I think that if everyone, you know, decided to step away from their own comforts and their own entertainment in order to be part of that, we would have been far more effective. I don't think we would have been able to be ignored. We weren't ignored, but we definitely didn't have the impact that we could have had. And I think that I credit that a lot to my generation's, you know, just this weird thing where people go online, they read an article, they post it on Facebook, and they feel that they're part of some revolution because they decide to post something that's radical.
I mean, I remember I posted something on Facebook and on IndieBay today.
Yeah, but you're doing something. You're doing something physical. You know, you're offering radio shows. There's plenty of people my own age that just smoke weed, and you know, they think they're radical. They think they're revolutionaries, but they're not doing anything physical. What made us different, what made me different, what made, you know, other people my own age different is we actually got up, we did something physical. We fed people, we built structures, we did intelligence gathering, we did what we knew we needed to do.
2 years ago.
2 years ago. And that...
Anything recent, Mr. Security Guard guy?
You know, I've tried. I really do try to not work, but, I mean, I really think that by and large, our generation is really compliant, and those who aren't, we're part of the Occupy Movement, and I think that a lot of people got scared off and feel, you know, and feel to this day broken, you know, feel a certain quality of just worn down, and I think...
Oh, yeah, I'm wearing an I Was in the Building t-shirt, but...
you know, and I feel that... Yeah, you know, it's weird. It's like that was the one thing that I think those of people in my generation who were trying to change the world were involved in, and being that it kind of failed.
There was a large strike on campus briefly for 2 days, a couple of days ago. Although, again, it was sort of part of a series of strikes across the country that was sort of orchestrated and was very limited across the state.
Yeah. You know, that's not what we... That's a very small thing. Like, what we as a country really need is we need people occupying massive areas and turning them into
classes. What I'm saying is that people were not afraid. A few people were not afraid to be arrested.
Students get away with stuff like that all the time. The government lets students get away with stuff like that on their own campus when they're younger so that they can feel in their older years that they did something, when reality,
it
doesn't do anything. No. You know, you want to change society, you get out on the working street, the working man's street, and, you know, you get out where we were, you know, St. Lorenzo Park next to the courtroom. That's where you need to, you know, create change.
So when are you starting the next Occupy Movement, Mr. Chuck?
I was hoping that it would happen April 4th. It was supposed to happen April 4th.
Really?
Nobody
showed up to the damn Occupy?
Today's
April 5th, I guess. Maybe they're a day late.
You know, I was reading about it today online, and I guess it just didn't hit a national level. I often do call up people, and...
We're going to pause briefly, because on the line with us is a former occupier, ancient man, Dennis Etler. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there, Robert. I can barely hear you.
How about now?
Well, slightly better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to tell you except hello, Dennis.
Okay, well, right, I'm here, so fire away.
Well, I don't know if you've been listening to the show. You probably haven't, right?
What's that?
Have you been listening to the show?
Yeah, you got to scream into the mic.
Oh, boy. Well, I don't know what the problem is. I mean, I think you have we have a bad phone connection because...
Well, I'm on my landline, so it should be better than... I'm up in Boulder Creek, so...
Well, listen carefully. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you as long as
we've been talking about
in the background.
Have you been listening to the show? Have you been listening to the show?
No, I've been kind of preoccupied.
Okay, well, preoccupied. Well, of course, occupy is what we've been discussing, actually.
Right, not preoccupied in that sense of the word, but yeah.
And you were a part of the Occupy movement for quite a while.
Well, you know, kind of, I came on board a little bit after it had gained some momentum. I was not one of the, activists, so to speak. I mean, but I attended the General Assemblies, and I began to taper off. Just by default, became more involved. There were just less people, so those who did attend were kind of, more in the limelight than, than not.
And in fact, you actually continued. The Occupy movement was really crushed in early December of 2011 when the San Lorenzo campground and the, the Hogan or the Wigwam or the Dome, I guess it was called, the Occudome,
right,
was destroyed
right.
Yeah, by the
sheriff. I was attending, occasionally. I was pretty much, involved with teaching, at various local community colleges, and that really took up most of my time. So
there much interest in the Occupy movement among the Cabrillo folks that you taught, or you the Cabrillo community?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the things when I did attend the meetings with the General Assemblies, the GAs, and, I did connect with some Cabrillo students, and I got to be the faculty advisor for the local Occupy Cabrillo Club, which never engaged in any actual Occupy on the campus, but it was a support group for the Santa Cruz Occupy.
Has anything come out of that Occupy movement you're aware of? I know for a time there was a group that Joy and others did in trying to press on with educating the community about Wells Fargo's foreclosure fraud and attempts to rein that in at a state level or even at a national level. But I haven't heard hair nor hide of that for the last... I don't know, year and a half, and as far as I know, the foreclosures are continuing, and I don't know that they've even slowed down.
It can be discouraging, and on the national level, the Occupy movement seems to be in somewhat of a recession. So yeah, I mean, a lot of people who were involved apparently, have continued in. Their involvement in different ways, sort of spin-offs from that. So it was not for naught. I mean, it sort of got a whole bunch of people who hadn't previously been involved in that sort of mass, political movement. They got a lot of people involved that, had never been so. So it was a very important...
Now, mass political movements have,
Yeah, you're fading away.
I'm right here. You gotta listen to me because I'm talking loud and I'm not, everybody else who calls in can hear me, but you can't.
Is this
a conspiracy?
I'm trying,
what's
my best.
Going on here?
I don't know what the problem is.
I don't know either. It's...
Okay, it might be my line. I'm playing with the cord and it seems a little bit better
now. All right,
now.
How's that now?
That's better, yeah.
All right, there have been mass political movements in this country that have had some impact on foreign policy. I mean, it seemed to take, a decade to, it wasn't really the United States that stopped the Vietnam War. It was the Vietnamese people and the victory of the Viet Cong and the, the North Vietnamese that stopped the Vietnam War, obviously. But there was some, impact on all this. I mean, Nixon was dissuaded from using nuclear weapons there and so forth. And also, recently, Obama was dissuaded from further interventions in Syria. Currently, we have a situation in the Ukraine where, rather disturbing news accounts have come out of the current Ukrainian government, either endorsing or ignoring or supporting attacks on eastern Ukrainian secessionists who have taken over, in the fashion of Maiden Square, some of the public buildings of the eastern Ukraine, demanding autonomy or a plebiscite or even a closer affiliation with Russia.
Yeah, well, initially, you know, they were, you know, basically, you know, calling for a certain degree of self-determination and, you know, a looser federation, you know, with the western Ukraine, because, you know, well, the Ukraine, you know, that whole situation, you know, historically is very, very complex. I mean, the country itself was kind of cobbled together over the decades and centuries. It's rather disparate, you know, grouping of people. And historically, it's a very complex, you know, situation. So, yeah, I mean, there are these internal divisions. I mean, for, well, since the Ukraine was, you know, part of the Soviet Union and certain lands that were traditionally Russian were ceded to, the Ukrainian, you know, Soviet Socialist Republic, which was part of the USSR, you know, Khrushchev, who was a Ukrainian himself, you know, basically gifted Crimea to Ukraine and the Russian-speaking eastern provinces were basically given to Ukraine, you know, with the founding of the Soviet Union back in around 1922. Yeah, so it's a complex history. You know, the western Ukraine traditionally was part of Poland and Lithuania. You know, there was Poland had been partitioned between Germany and Russia and Austria-Hungary back in the 1790s, and the what was it? The eastern part of Poland, you know, was then you know cleaved away from post-war Poland and given to the Soviet Union and incorporated into Ukraine as well. So it's really a disparate, you know, conglomeration, whatever you want to call it. Well, so there are these historic, you know,
the recent concerns that I've seen, and I'm trying to cook up a narrative of my own that I feel is, you know, independent of the passionate. Well, we had a meeting yesterday where you and others are quite passionately demanding, and perhaps rightfully so, you know, to U.S. out of the Ukraine, that there's recently been massive U.S. involvement, at least over the last few years, starting with the Orange Revolution back in 2004.
The western part of Ukraine, which has ties to, like I say, Poland, and during the war, you know, there was a fascistic movement, you know, that allied itself with the Nazis in the western part of Ukraine, and you know, they basically participated in pogroms against, you know, Jews and Russians, and, you know, they were, you know, really a fascist, you know, a Nazi allied movement.
As well as a nationalist Ukrainian movement, extreme.
Well,
nationalist.
Yeah, well, I mean, nationalism, I mean, that's why, you know, it's National Socialism. You know, that's where, you know, the term Nazi comes from. I mean, it's these rabid nationalists where, you know, they believe in, you know, sort of, you know, the national spirit. You know, it's a really reactionary, you know, type of ideology that sees, you know, one group in opposition to, you know, other populations that, you know, inhabit, you know, the territory that, you know, they've coexisted in for centuries, but they want to basically ethnically cleanse, you know, their territory and either exterminate or drive out, you know, populations that don't share their ethnicity.
Dennis, isn't it also a, you know, reaction to overweening control by foreign powers as well? So, for example, you know, Hitler in Germany was essentially in reaction to the Versailles Treaty and the stripping of
Germany. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to be an apologist for fascism and the Nazis. I'm just not going there. I mean, you can always make up some sort of apologetics for the most reactionary, you know, obscene type of ideology. I mean, I'm just not going to, you know, offer any rationalization for fascists. I'm just not. That's not where I'm going. You know, forget it.
I don't think I'm asking for that.
That's exactly what you're leading to about. Oh well, didn't they have some legitimate type of grievance that they were responding to? You know, the overweening, influence of, say, the Soviet Union, and
I'm saying,
forget it. I'm not, nonsense.
Excuse me. In countries where there is a nationalist upheaval of different kinds, sometimes it's progressive, sometimes it's reactionary. It often comes from the suppression of minorities.
Well, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean,
so let's not call. Wait a minute. So let's not play the let's not play the fascist card.
Dennis.
Let's not play the fascist card and say simply that I'm defending fascists. I'm not defending fascists. I'm trying to understand what's going on in the Ukraine.
You know, the genocidal, Third Reich. I'm not going there, Robert.
Yeah, as I said, I'm not defending fascists. I'm trying to understand nationalist movements when they come up.
Well, sure. I mean,
and not to simply label everybody
who's a nationalist, where they're opposing, the Vietnamese and many African and Latin American national liberation movements, which I support, and, that they are internationalist in ideology, and they're fighting for their national salvation against U.S. imperialism or British imperialism or French imperialism. Yeah, so, no, I mean, there's obviously differences in terms of the nature of the nationalism that's being discussed.
Dennis, we have trouble because I can't get a word in here, but...
That's okay.
It's not okay. No. In some cases, Russian imperialism, yes?
It was the union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Was Stalin a Russian?
I think he was Georgian, wasn't he?
He was a Georgian. Was Khrushchev a Russian? He was a Ukrainian. So this idea that the Soviet Union was just, Russian, no. It was a union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And there was a reality to that because it was dissolved voluntarily, in 1991. I mean, there was no war of succession. There was no civil war like we had in our country. When the South wanted to secede, we had a war, about that. When the Federated Republics of the Soviet Union decided, to give up the ghost, they just went their separate ways. And it was just dissolved, went out with a whimper, not a bang. So... what kind of imperialism are you talking about?
Well, I mean, you can go back further into the 19th century and you'll find Russian imperialism, no?
Well, that's what the revolution was against. The revolution was to create a fraternal union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was a voluntary union.
Yeah, and the French Revolution sought to end French imperialism, too, I'm sure, in their own way.
And there was a reaction.
But then you got the French imperialism.
Well, the French Revolution was a bourgeois revolution, and eventually, what was progressive becomes reactionary, Mm-hmm. That happens all the time. And
well, let's get back to your latest updates on the Ukraine and your thoughts on what's happening there.
Well, what's happening, as far as I can tell by what I see online and, view on RT, Russia Today, which is the only news that I really watch any longer, the corporate media, both broadcast and cable, is just outrageous, totally corporately controlled, spewing lies, distortions, and, just outright fabrications. I mean, today, of course, Obama was giving a speech commemorating the victims of the Holocaust. I mean, what a total, just outrageous joke when, he's funding and supporting fascist, you know, marauders in Odessa that, you know, just, you know, were going about slaughtering innocents, and he's out there, you know, commemorating the victims of Nazi atrocities when he's supporting the very same forces in Ukraine. It's just outrageous.
Well, I notice, I'm looking at Russia Today, since you brought it up, and the latest, there's a video from Mariupol City Council building of armed Ukrainian men surrounding the building, deployed to dismantle barricades, but as anti-Kiev activists tried to negotiate, the armed men opened fire.
Yeah, well, these are armed men. These are neo-Nazi stormtroopers that have been recruited by the, you know, Ukrainian junta in Kiev. They've been recruiting these, you know, these fascist gangs and putting them into the National Guard and militias and deploying them to East, you know, Ukraine to basically, you know, conduct pogroms against, you know, the Russian-speaking population.
Specifically, though, against those who have tried to take over buildings and establish a secessionist movement, right?
Well, they're taking, I mean, you know, this illegitimate government in Kiev, which was installed by the U.S. in a coup, you know, ousting the legitimate, democratically elected government, and, you know, it's a purely self-defense, you know, by the eastern, you know, Russian-speaking Ukrainians,
but you,
to ward off, you know, these fascistic
forces from taking over. I'm not talking about their motivation. I'm talking about the fact that the armed Kievian Kiev government, what you call fascist gangs, aren't marauding the countryside at random, going after Russian-speaking people.
Yes, they are.
Well, wait a minute. What I've read and what I've heard...
Well, where have you read and heard?
Let me finish what I'm saying first, because I want to be able to get the sentence out.
You know.
And that is that they are, in fact, going after groups of people that have taken over government buildings. Is that accurate?
Word I read or hear on MSNBC.
Is that... You know, you're not answering my question. Maybe we're not able to communicate with each other because we can't hear each other. Can you hear what I'm saying?
Listening to these.
Can you hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. There are, just like there was the Maidan group, you know, who eventually took over the Kiev government.
Oh, no, it wasn't the Maidan group that took over the Kiev government. It was the fascist and neo-Nazi stormtroopers that took over the government. The Maidan protesters were a bunch of naive liberals who thought that they were going to, you know, get a gravy train by joining up with the EU, unbeknownst to them, of course. The IMF and the neoliberals had a whole different agenda, which was to impose an austerity even more severe than what you've seen in Greece and Spain and Portugal.
You know, it's not that I disagree with you here at all. It's just that I probably, you know, maybe I disagree in some parts, but I'm saying that there was a movement by the Maidan protesters, initially peaceful, and then, as you said, some would say taken over by extremists.
Not some. It was taken over.
And you're interrupting me. I know you don't like what I'm saying, but you got to let me finish my sentence, if you don't mind. And whether you mind or not, I'm going to finish my sentence. And that is that there is a group of people. There are people who want to overturn the government. And they started, you know, in the Maidan protest, just as the people in Tunisia and the people in
Egypt. Wait a minute.
I'm not trying to glorify all parts of this group. I'm saying that there are people who are forming a counter movement to the government. And
protest.
I frankly, I'm a fan of those who do that often, although sometimes I'm not. All right, so I'm going to have to give you a chance to respond, but I don't think you're going to respond to anything I'm saying because you can't really hear what I'm saying.
Into Ukraine. You know what they're doing now? You know, eastern Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. And you know what's underneath all of that, you know, that land? Gas. Immense gas shale deposits, which they want to frack. You know, so France has just outlawed fracking Germany is against fracking. All of Europe is against fracking, and they're getting their gas from the natural gas fields in Russia. Well, you know, the U.S., you know, the Koch brothers, who are really big into fracking, they want to take over the eastern Ukrainian oil, you know, and gas shale deposits for fracking. I mean, you know, there's articles you can consult online, you know, from, industry sources. You know, that's the whole idea, is to wean Europe away from Russian gas and frack, you know, the hell out of Ukraine.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's why they want Ukraine.
I don't necessarily deny that. The trouble is, we can't have much of a back and forth because, first of all, we can't hear each other. We can't hear each other very well. Well, go on.
You know,
I think we have to be telling you the way it is. Yeah, no, we have to be in the studio at some point. And I think maybe I can coax you into the studio on Sunday at some point. You've been very generous with your time.
Sunday I think I have plans to go over the hill to visit some friends in San Jose.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
In any case, my point is that it's become, you know, whether it's the Occupy movement in this country or different other encampments that rise.
Well, you know, one thing you got to get straight.
I got to finish this sentence. I'm sorry, Dennis. Whether it's the Occupy movement in this country or other encampments in, you know, whether it's Ukraine on the right or, you know, secessionist movements on the left. In the eastern Ukraine, these are movements that are rising up for different reasons. And I think, we really are having trouble. We can't really have much of a dialogue here. Anyway, go ahead with what you want to say. Go ahead.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I can't seem to get out something without you interrupting me. And then we can't hear each other because I want to hear what you have to say. Your interruption is not that it isn't relevant, but it destroys my chance of making my point.
Okay, make your point. Go ahead.
Well, the point that was being made is that there are these, you know, you made the statement 10 minutes ago that armed fascist gangs are roaming the country, going after Russian-speaking people. I'm not saying that isn't necessarily true, but the media, what happened most recently in this event, the situation over in eastern Ukraine involving the burning alive and shooting of people in that burning building.
Yeah, in Odessa, which is in the southern part of Ukraine on the Black Sea.
Thank you. There was an encampment outside the government building, that was essentially in opposition to the existing Kiev government, which has, you know, local representatives there. And these were attacks on the encampment.
Right.
So, you know, and the attacks on the encampment were, maybe you can advise me. Did the Kiev government state, they are stating that they're attempting to crush the secessionist movement, which they regard as, you know, sedition.
Well, they refer to them as secessionists and terrorists.
Right, right. Bullshit city.
Give me a break.
In fact, what we're talking about, if we want to be fair in our analysis, is these are government people trying to crush an anti-government movement, which we may support, given the situation. But it's not they're running in to start shooting Russians at random or Russians.
Well, they aren't.
Well, let me put it this way.
Well, they are. They burnt this trade union building to cover up the massacre of the people who sought refuge inside. There is documentary evidence that, you know, that the majority of the people who died in that building did not die from the fire or smoke inhalation. They were shot.
Yes, but you're missing my point. These were people.
And then the fire.
No. The point I have is that these were people who originally came from an anti-government.
Crime committed.
There were people who came from an anti-government encampment.
Well, you know, the whole Maidan thing was anti-government. It went on for months. And the Ukrainian government basically didn't do anything for months on end.
You know, your passion is overwhelming your attempt to even understand what I'm talking about.
And the
your passion is missing my point, Dennis.
False flag operation,
Dennis,
that led to the coup.
Dennis, my point is just that. That the same kind of anti-government, you know, in some case, you know, the government, you know, there was, you know, I guess the prior government was tolerating this, you know, large movement.
Exactly, for months on end.
But that's not. But the point is, it was an anti-government movement. Just
they didn't
as,
do anything.
I can't. It's hard here.
Dispersed that. Yeah, we have. All right, so let's control crowd. But they didn't. They let it, you know, fester and eventually.
My point is, and I'm going to make it because I think it's important. We're just getting, you know, we're talking over each other just too much. Is that it? The people that were attacked and burned in the building came from an anti-government camp. That they were peaceful, they were part of a protest, but they came from that camp and they were being dispersed. And they attempt to flee armed, you know, you might call them, you know, Nazi goon squads or fascist goon squads or fascist-minded goon squads from the, you know, the Kiev central government. But it was a political struggle. They were not out to shoot Russian-speaking people at random. And I don't want you to spread that impression, I think, is horseshit. That's my view.
Well, they, you know, they're sending these goons, you know, into East Ukraine, and they're attacking the checkpoints that the people of East Ukraine have set up.
Right, secessionist checkpoints that you and I might agree with, but that these are political differences. They are not a matter of, you know, murderous squads that are randomly killing people. Period.
Are killing people.
They are killing people, but they are killing people in a political struggle.
Well, of course it's political.
Okay, well then we don't...
I mean, the whole goddamn thing is political. What are you talking about? In a it's political. Obviously it's political.
Okay, well that's the only... That's the only point I made.
What point? There's no point.
Well, it is
a
point.
Of course it's political, because you have fascists and anti-fascists, and you know, when you have people of differing ideologies who are, you know, struggling with one another, it's obviously political.
You
I mean, it's been politicized.
Yes, but the political is not so much the ideology. The political is...
Well, how can you...
The political is that there are government and anti-government forces, whether it's fascist or some other kind of government. That's my point.
The ideology on one side, and, you know, and people who want to live in peace, want to live with their Ukrainian-speaking neighbors as they have for generations, who, you know, have no qualms or no fight with anybody. They're just, you know, working people, miners and farmers. They just want to live their life. And then you have these fascist gangs that want to ethnically cleanse and exterminate their so-called enemies. Of course that's political.
Well, you didn't hear what I was saying because you were talking. But, you know, that's okay.
I don't understand what your point is.
Well, I told you the point is it's government versus anti-government forces. Whatever the political ideology, that's the reality of it. And I'm saying that we certainly, it's important what the ideology is, obviously. But it's also important to recognize that this is a specific government, anti-government struggle. And that's what's going on. So any government... Naturally, you know, U.S. government, the Venezuelan
government. Oh, so now you're defending the Ukrainian government?
I don't want to hear these personal attacks on me because I'm trying to clarify a point I'm making. You know, the point I'm making is...
The country?
The point I'm making is, let's say even in Venezuela, a country we both probably have some sympathy for, their government, you know, they are, you know, defending themselves or attacking anti-government forces. And
the anti-government forces are attacking the government.
That too.
And the government is defending itself.
That too, for sure.
I mean,
right.
You know, you can't just take this neutral stance, you know, sort of hover above the conflict and, you know, sort of, tits for tat, a pox.
Oh, wait a minute, Dennis. Weren't you the one who told me that it was okay, you were standing aside while the generals took over in Egypt, and you just sort of watched that whole thing? I'm just an observer, you said.
Talking about Egypt now?
Well, I jumped to that one because it contradicts what you just said. I mean, yes, I think it's important to take sides, and yes, I also think it's important to clarify independently of your ideology as best you can what's going on. You know, in addition to that,
government has been doing. I mean, I was not in support of what the you know, Muslim Brotherhood was doing. The people in their millions, you know, said no to Morsi, and then the army stepped in and overthrew him. And I'm not surprised that the army is now, you know, repressing the you know, the people's movement in Egypt, and I support the resistance against the army now.
Mm-hmm.
I supported the resistance against the Muslim Brotherhood, and now I support the resistance against Saudi Arabian-supported
military. I don't think you can get away with that. They're not proportionate in any way at the present time. The Morsi Brotherhood was in no way as repressive.
Come on, the Morsi Brotherhood.
As the military government is today against all comers. But, you know, we could argue that's another show's discussion.
They were attacking, the secular, protesters.
That's another show's discussion, Dennis, really. Dennis, that's another show's discussion? I think that is another show's discussion. We're talking with Dennis Etler. I'm talking at Dennis Etler. It's kind of hard to get this going. Dennis,
people said, no, we don't want this.
Dennis, we need to be in the studio together, I think, because there's a combination of problems. One is that we can't hear We can't hear each other well. The other is we're both passionate about these issues. I really appreciate your patience with me, particularly since I've got control of the mic here.
Trying to wrest it from you, that's all.
You are, indeed. And how can you do it when you're not in the studio? You have to bring in some of your armed Stalinist thugs.
Come on now. It sounds like you're the one that's supporting, these neo-fascists.
Yeah, I've always been a fan of the fascists. That's
not,
me, They don't call me Fascist Fred for nothing. Listen, I've got about 10 minutes left in the show. You are working on, as am I, in organizing resistance to U.S. support for the Kiev regime, whether you want to call it neo-fascist, extreme rightist, whatever the hell you want to call it, and its current, murderous policies in the eastern Ukraine.
Right.
What's coming up around that? What should we be aware of?
Okay, well, we are going to have, a gathering at Cooper Plaza Wednesday, this coming Wednesday the 14th at 2 p.m., where we'll have, placards and whatever, signage, denouncing our, involvement, our meaning our country's involvement in the, situation in Ukraine. And then we'll have some informational flyers that we will begin distributing up and down Pacific Ave. And then we'll, reconvene at Cooper Plaza at 3 p.m. for rally and, maybe...
Where is Cooper Plaza?
And then we're going to build for another event, the week following, where hopefully we can gather a number of people to present Sam Farr with a list of demands that he, resist what the administration is attempting to do. We want him to support the demands that we have, to end the sanctions against Russia, to demand a democratic solution to the situation in Ukraine, to disarm and demobilize the fascist, militias, and, to not support the government in Kiev, but to, go back to the original Geneva agreement in which, there was a plan for a government of national unity, and that both the EU and Russia would work together to help solve the fiscal and economic problems
Two things, Dennis. Let me interrupt you. Let me interrupt you, Dennis. I'm going to keep working at interrupting you here. The Cooper Plaza is what, right across from the Cinema 9 we're talking about?
Right. Cooper House.
I don't think nobody knows what there isn't any Cooper. Is there a Cooper House anymore? I don't think.
Well, that's what it's called. It's on Cooper Street, 110 Cooper Street.
The second thing is, one of the concerns, do you think that either the Russian secessionists or the, for that matter, the if any Western secessionists, let's assume the government reverted to its previous.
Let's put it this way.
Would they be willing to come? Are you also would they be willing to get to abide by these agreements, and are they going to be a part of this negotiating process?
Let's put it this way. Until you know, the U.S. began, playing its games of regime change and interventionism, there was no talk in Ukraine for secession by the Russian-speaking population of the East. There was no call for, you know, Crimea, you know, going back to Mother Russia. That was not on anybody's agenda. The only reason that, you know, people are demanding, a looser federation, and the only reason that Crimea was basically returned, to Russia, was because of the policies of this, you know, neo-fascist regime that was imposed on the country by the rightist forces in Maidan. When they staged the coup in Kiev with the explicit support of the U.S. I mean, you know, we had our envoys going there, arm in arm, with these Svoboda fascists who were, giving the fascist, Sieg Heil salute. I mean, so, the only reason for this whole situation is because of the attempts by the U.S. and, the allies that we have basically recruited in Ukraine to basically try to, take over the country and impose a neoliberal, neo-imperialist regime on the people.
So we're going to have to leave it there, Dennis. And I know you have a website you've set up, a Facebook page where people can get more information. What is that site?
Okay, it's called A Coalition to Stop the Madness, Say No to U.S. Support for Eurofascism in Ukraine.
Coalition to Stop the Madness, Say No to Eurofascism in the Ukraine.
Right.
Dennis, thank you for your patience, and I will try and get a better connection or maybe even get you, hog-tie you in the studio, and I'll, have to have a gag ready if necessary.
Okay.
And
thanks for having me on, and I appreciate your patience.
Oh, you're a man of good humor in the face of overweening authoritarianism.
Okay.
Thanks, care. Man. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
And I got about 5 minutes left in the show. If anybody has any comments, call in fast, 427-3772. There is a proposal coming up in the evening agenda at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting next Tuesday. It isn't actually a law. It is a proposal to discuss a law, something like that, which is coming from Don Lane and Pamela Comstock. You want to talk about the odd couple. They are called Revising Street Performance and Display Device Rules Downtown. It directs the city attorney to return to council with ordinance amendments to implement a new framework for regulating display devices based on plainly marked performance and tabling locations, with a report back to the council 6 months after implementation, and requesting that the City Arts Commission and staff consider development of programs to encourage downtown street performances based on council direction provided at its May 13, 2014 meeting, and that's going to be next Tuesday. What that really means is little protest pens or performance pens where it's marked out on the sidewalk, the tiny spots you'll be allowed to perform and table at, with the rest of the whole area essentially monopolized by the merchants and the commercial interests of the downtown area. It's an outrageous power grab, masquerading as a measure that's being done to clarify what, where it's legal to play and where it's not. Because the police are doing a combination of things. They're abusively targeting some people, like the scarf lady Kate, with her vending activity with scarves. Officer Barnett is notorious for that. And then they're conspicuously ignoring many other musicians and performers who are taking up more than 12 square feet, who are closer than 14 feet to a building or a crosswalk or a bench or whatever, who don't have a freestanding display device, who aren't 12 feet from each other as was required by the outrageous laws voted in by the city council this last fall. Now what's suggested is that these laws be set in cement, and not only that they be demonstrated to the world with white paint. I suppose some would say this will show how outrageous the Santa Cruz City is, but I'm afraid we are in such a police state mentality here that it'll become the basis for other cities to act. Instead of our fine street performers voluntary guidelines, which served so well for 22 years, and then were destroyed by Ed Porter and Emily Riley in 2003 on their council, which essentially said, you know, we don't need no stinking laws. All we need are voluntary understandings between people, and that worked fine. But in order to get rid of, at the behest of the merchants, panhandlers and homeless people sitting downtown, they had to create something that would uniformly deal with everyone on the streets, which swept up street performers. And now what they're trying to do is they're concretizing that mistake, that discriminatory behavior. And it may be the only way we have out of this, a combination of direct action and court action. There's also more discussion on the internet about Steve Plaich's shrinking moratorium proposal. Now, apparently, he doesn't suggest it for a year. He suggests it for 6 months. Steve has a website, Citizens for a Better Santa Cruz, which is very responsive to Take Back Santa Cruz pressure, or pressure from people who certainly sound like they